Hello, and welcome to Morning Energy Live. I'm your host, Andrew Gillick, and today I have the pleasure of looking into our energy future with Ben Wilson. Ben's Director of Products and Solution for Energy at AWS. That title to me seems kind of like energy sector strategist, sort of made up. I'm not really sure what that means, but I guess we'll find out. Welcome, Ben.
Hey, Andrew, thank you so much for having me here. You know, when I originally signed up for this, I actually thought I was your smartest colleague. Now I reread this and it's generative AI is your smartest colleague. I mean, come on, I'm pretty
I
sure
mean,
I am.
I'm going to give you a chance. I'm going to give you a chance. So we'll see how it goes. So as you saw from today's title of the show, Ben's he probably has something to do with everybody's favorite buzzword or Gen AI. And until a few months ago, I was in the camp of Gen AI is just some fad that folks in Silicon Valley are pumping to hit their IPO targets or make NVIDIA options pay out. That's actually before I started to understand what it was, how it's impacting my life, and how it's going to impact the sector I find near and dear to my heart. But before we jump into learning about that, let's get to know Ben a little better with a few probing questions. That work?
Yeah, absolutely. Go for it.
All right, ready? So Ben, what is the first concert you ever went to?
It was Joan Jett, and it was awesome.
That
She
sounds
is total
pretty
rock
sweet.
star. I love Joan Jett.
I love it. All right. Next question, beach or mountains? Now wait, this is a year-round commitment, not seasonal. So just to be clear.
I get it. It's always the beach. It's always the beach.
Even in the snow, I kind of feel like the beach is a relaxing place to be.
I grew up in Chicago and it was always cold there. As soon as I had a
That's good.
chance to go to university, I ended up going down south so I could be warm.
I understand. I understand. All right, next question. Have you been to more countries or states?
I have been to more states. I've been to about 27 countries and 32 states.
Quite the traveler. Quite the traveler. I like it. All right, next question. What is your favorite color of hydrogen?
Well, I mean, I have to say blue. I'd rather say green, but I'm not sure where all the power is going to come from. So for me, I say blue.
Especially if all that power is getting sucked into AI stuff that we'll talk about later.
Exactly.
I'm just saying.
Exactly.
I think our team would agree with you. Blue is the way to go and to make money as it stands today. All right. Last question, the most important one. What is the best sandwich?
No, there's. Has to be pastrami on rye. Has to be.
Oof. Mustard? Russian?
Of
How do
course.
you go? Both?
Mustard and horseradish. A spicy
Oh.
mustard and horseradish. Got to have both.
I think I might go to Mendy's delicatessen for lunch today. We'll see. And now you got me inspired. Okay, Ben, thank you.
Awesome.
That was great. All right, so let's get started. Let's start out. Maybe you could tell the audience a little bit about how you found your way to AWS and what you do there today. Give a little set the stage.
Yeah, absolutely, man. First, I do want to make sure I say, Andrew, thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm very grateful, and especially since I love talking about technology and AI. But like when you look at my career, it's really been at the crossroads of like energy and technology for the last 25 years, typically working on the most complex software engineering projects in the world. This is where I thrive and I enjoy the challenges the most, and I love problems that people say are extremely difficult. But if they say it's impossible, I'll probably like it a lot more. But right now, I am the Director of Products and Solutions at AWS. I have a team of engineers helping me build software and generative AI solutions for customers. Before this, I was CTO at GE, at P2 Energy Solutions, Siemens, and I was also the energy CTO for Google. And in many cases, I was working with complex customers like NASA and Boeing and others like that.
So you sort of sit at the crossroads of energy and technology is
Yeah, I mean,
what I see that.
back in the day, I did what we used to call M2M, which is machine to machine, dropping DSL lines to power plants so we could go and do diagnostics on them. So that's where
Some
I
of
started on this journey and trying to do that.
the younger listeners might not know what a DSL line is, but that's for, another history related podcast. So we'll get to that another time.
Absolutely.
All right, so let's get to the crux of it. What really is this Gen AI thing? Isn't it what we called machine learning just a few years ago? Is it really going to be the most useful tech we've ever developed? Should I buy some Skynet stock?
Yeah, Skynet. Well, I don't even buy Skynet on the dip, of course.
Okay, of course. Yeah,
But
it's the best way to invest.
it is the best way to invest. I agree. But like the thing I think about is this is a big question, and I like to break it down to three parts. And because using any tool correctly is important, especially when it's so accessible to anyone via like the web page on an internet. Now, the first part is I think you need to understand a little bit of history, right? Because when you think of AI, it's been evolving for a long time, since 1956, when John McCarthy and this guy named Marvin Minsky and others at the Dartmouth conference coined the term artificial intelligence. And the field was officially born, and the idea of using AI as a tool was started. So we need to keep in mind this stuff isn't new. Now, the second part of your question was around machine learning. Machine learning is a refined AI tool. It's gained, you know, wider acceptance over the last 7 years. And to create the algorithm, these types of algorithms requires a specific use case and labeling of the data used to create the algorithm. To create the algorithms was tedious, and it was a long process. And one popular use case they used was images for quality control. We provide images that meet the quality bar and then images that did not meet the quality bar. Then you provide the algorithm an image it had never seen before. And you ask it whether it met the quality bar or not. Believe it or not, this is a really, really successful model for a lot of companies. And I actually helped build a few of these. But the limitation was lots of labeled data and very specific use cases. Now let's go to the third part. What are LLMs or generative AI? And what's going on today?
What is an LLM? Tell us what an LLM is.
Absolutely. It's something we call a large language model.
Okay.
Right? And it's yet another refinement of AI as a tool. Now, the key for these LLMs or generative AI, that as we speak about it, these models don't require any specific use case or data labeling. What they can do is just learn from large-scale data like on the internet. So you can, many of these models just troll the entire internet and bring that data in. It's a bit easier to create these models, but to me, the largest difference this time is AI is much more accessible. It's just about anyone has access to it. Literally, it's a text box on a screen. You can drop almost any question in and see an answer. Now, before, it was a domain of specialists and engineers. And the one thing to know, many of these models were trained on just generally available data from that internet. So the chances of it being able to answer questions like, hey, can you give me all the squeeze job records that were performed in the last 3 days that were underbalanced and had surface pressure greater than 200 bar? Pretty low. So, but
especially when you don't know what a squeeze job is, that would be something.
If you don't know what a squeeze job in the industry is,
yeah.
When you go and do a hole and you're trying to fill that hole up and you got cracks in some of the cement and you got to go down there and fill those cracks up, that's a squeeze job. But
all right.
When you go do drilling, this is a very common problem that you have. And what if you could take all of your drilling records and upload it to the LLM and now be able to ask these questions and be able to get really meaningful answers back? That's the thing we want to be able to do, is upload that context-specific information and be able to then ask these very specific questions. Two things I want to point out before we jump off this is, one is, there are ways to go and make this better and easier. It's called retrieval augmented generation. And it doesn't mean you lose control of your data, because if you just log on to a web-based chat tool, you put your data into it, usually you're giving your data away. If you don't want to go do that, right, what you want to do is conduct your LLM activities in the cloud. It's easier to protect and control your data. The second thing I want to mention is using RAG will reduce the likelihood of generating incorrect information. It does not mean it was always get right, because we have to remember these generative AI models are not always giving you 100% the right answer. Does that make sense?
Totally. So like ChatGPT, which I think most of the folks are familiar with, uses the World Wide Web. They scrape the internet and like whatever's out there, they come back to you with an answer. But the way to get more accurate answers is to have sort of a closed model with your data and your research and all your stuff up in the cloud that you're going to help curate to make sure the AI is bringing back the right information. Is that right?
That is 100% right. And you really need to think this stuff through. I mean, when I think about it, what you want to do is get the high precision data. And one of the questions I ask customers as I talk to them is, I say, you know, listen, how accurate is that detailed five-tab spreadsheet you've been using? How accurate is that? Are you certain it's 100%
five,
correct?
Five tabs, pretty accurate. But when you get to the 30 tabs, then I'm a little worried.
Okay, that's right. But what you're trying to do is create like a possibility to make, and you want to make sure it's right, right? And you, and how do you make sure it's right? You use things like checksums, validation formulas, and audit tools. And it turns out that spreadsheet, when it's engineered correctly, is very reliable and informative. And that's what we want.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. So what does it mean for companies today, particularly in the energy space, that are trying to use generative AI?
Well, I mean, I'd say a couple things. One thing is, I want to talk about precision just for a moment, right? Precision. With generative AI, what you want to do is get to precision, right? And so what you want to do is basically think about kind of two things, right? First is using imprecise expressions of words to ask generative AI a question. And the data that you use today is oftentimes from the internet, and that's imprecise too. So we got to think about this, is your imprecision with the question you ask. And if you're just using data from the internet, that's also imprecise. We as engineers, we like to have precise answers, right? And we want to be able to think about it that way. So for me, when I think about getting to precise answers, I actually think about Ural's instant analyst. What Enveris has is lots of very precise data that's been curated. That data set, once loaded into an LLM, augments that LLM to answer much more specific questions. So if you loaded it with all of your, you know, weekly drilling reports, you could actually ask that question about the squeeze job and get a decent answer back.
Got it. Well, that makes sense. If you're, you know, in a defined area that you're looking for the answers, for sure. Okay. So if I'm Enveris or I'm another operator or trader or in the energy space, what's the best way for them to think about implementing this using somebody else's? You know, how are you seeing this sort of trend develop, you know, a year post ChatGPT?
I think we're seeing mostly POC still. We see a few things in production. We're excited to see Instant Analyst because that's in production with customers using it. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of the rare exception rather than the rule right now. People are really doing POCs. And when you think about POCs, right, what you want to think about is being able to kind of generate that confidence in the results you're getting, in the technical staff, and the organization as a whole. And one of the things I always try to tell folks is, like, don't think that your, you know, IT leader is the right one to go lead this. I think it's got to be a business person who takes the lead, and the IT folks who are very competent and helpful can help you along through that process, because that business leader will understand what's the outcome we're really trying to drive to. And it's up to the IT folks to be able to kind of help with that.
So work backwards. So set the goal. The goal is to achieve, to help the client with this challenge they have or this pain that they have, and then work backwards on how we can do that, supporting them faster or more accurately.
Absolutely. So when they do a POC or a proof of concept, right, that's what they really want to get to, is you want to get to a concept that demonstrates we reduce cost, increase revenue, something like that. Now, I've worked with a bunch of energy companies, and I've seen people do things like with HR policies and benefits, where they were able to go do that and be able to significantly reduce the time it takes for people to get answers, and also increase the accuracy of those answers using LLMs and generative AI. But also, the answers that the employees got, the employees liked them better, and they provided more context. And so what we're seeing is people start with these simple things that they can measure against up front. Then they go and implement it. They go check that benchmark and see if it got better. And if it got better, it generates that confidence in the results and the staff and so forth. And we see that happen over and over again.
Yeah, that's definitely something we're working on internally as well, with the questions and the answers and double checking. Hey, back to real quick, you mentioned you were talking about machine learning and then LLMs. If you're training the data on an LLM in a closed environment, why is that different than machine learning?
Well, the way to think about machine learning is it's a very specific use case where you have to label a lot of data. With an LLM, what you're doing is you're taking in basically all the data from the internet, and that's how it's learned to learn about many, many topics. When you use this thing called retrieval augmented generation, what you do is then augment that data with, for example, daily drilling reports that you can then ask about squeeze jobs. If you just ask about squeeze jobs without doing that retrieval augmented generation, you wouldn't be able to get the proper answer. And to be clear, you will not necessarily always get the correct answer unless you really have precise data that goes along with it.
Got it. And so, yeah, totally. And the precision, getting more precise or very high precision, comes with the iterations on the model, but also with the humans who are developing and the experts. And
I think what we're seeing is as you go through each iteration, you're getting more and more accurate. So when you think about things like forecasting and optimizing algorithms, when you augment those algorithms for optimization with results you're getting out of LLMs or generative AI, you actually get those algorithms to work better. It's not every time, right? We've seen some that are successful and some that have not been, but being able to have an incremental data set to help that optimization algorithm is always helpful.
Okay, so I know that one of the questions people get anxious about is, you know, AI taking my job, and I'm, as you're speaking, I'm thinking, well, we need the humans to make the models better. Is there a point where we don't?
Yeah,
and we just press go and, you know, put our feet up at the beach?
I always like to think about it in terms of, listen, humans make the decision, not machines, right? That's right. The way I think about it. But if you think about it, for many organizations, and I think probably almost all of them, AI is going to be an important part of everything they go do. If you think back to like 1993, when the internet was popularized with like Netscape, that was a foundational moment for the internet. And many things did change, even in the energy industry. If you think about it for a moment, could any of your organizations exist or operate without the internet today?
Well, we certainly wouldn't be doing this now, would we?
No. And so,
the answer is no.
Right, 100%.
Yeah.
But for me, when I think about a lot of these things, if you look at 2023, it will be a similar foundational moment for AI, but everything is going to be accelerated exponentially. And the reason is like, if we go, like AWS did a commissioned survey, and we found that 92% of businesses surveyed expect to use AI-powered solutions in their organizations by 2028. That's 4 years away. It took almost 20 years for the internet to develop into something indispensable. That is the speed at which we're moving.
That's intense. Well, so then if I'm an executive out there trying to figure out how to get started with this, what do I do? Where do I go?
I think, you know, first thing is, of course, your IT organization is going to be a very important part of this type of journey.
Yeah.
But I think you need to sit down first and figure out what are those use cases you want to work on? What are the ones that are going to be able to drive that value? Some customers we're seeing, they want to be able to prove that it works, so they do things in HR. Others want to just jump into it and be able to go look at like daily drilling reports I keep on speaking about. One of the things that people need to understand is this is something you almost have to do in the cloud unless you've got some significant data center capacity. The cloud allows you to be able to use almost any model you want. It also allows you to be able to protect your data. And it also allows you to do many, many iterations. You hear a lot of hype in the news today about GPUs and a need for GPUs. In the type of things we're talking about here in the energy industry, we don't need that many GPUs for that. That's not the big crux. The big crux
so
for
we're
us
not we're not driving NVIDIA stock.
No, I don't think so. I think many other companies who are developing these large language models, they're driving a lot of value. And we have many customers on AWS who are actually creating their own large language models and driving that. But in the activities we're doing every single day in the energy industry, we don't have that problem. What we're trying to drive is real results every day. And that's that augmentation of the data.
And so continuing to clean up the data, augment the data, optimize workflows, I guess. Is AI now being implemented in helping with forecasts and the optimization of the algorithms themselves?
In some cases, yeah. There are many instances where we've seen customers use the results out of generative AI or LLMs to be able to increase that forecasting accuracy. What we see a lot of is people trying to figure out like, hey, I've got a problem with my algorithm. How do I figure out why it's a problem? I constantly have, problem X. A large language model or generative AI help me figure out why I'm having that problem. And we see generative AI helping in those situations. It's not 100%, but we see that as being used as a tool. And that's the way I like to talk about these things is we talk about, like Skynet and all these things. And I think that's a little bit overblown. I think this is a refinement of AI tools that we've been using since 1956. It's another refinement. There will be another one behind it. And the question is how are you going to apply that tool against a problem you have? And when you apply a tool, you need to start with good data and good use cases. When you have those two things, there's literally miraculous things can sometimes happen.
Every time I talk to you, it's great because I'm learning something new. There's so much to sort of think about with the way the technology is evolving here. But one of the issues with this tech in particular is the amount of power that it draws from the grid. And we continue to hear stories about challenges of data centers having enough power and having to turn to diesel gen sets for 3 months because the utility can't provide them what they need. Amazon just made an announcement, right, to secure nuclear generation base load for a period of time. If we are just at the dawn of AI and what it's going to do in the next decade, like how short power are we? And does everybody on here who loves natural gas like get excited a little bit, maybe?
Well, I think I recently saw a article on Georgia's expected power crunch that they're going to have. And there was a data set that talked about in 2040, they had forecasted roughly 13,000 megawatts that was going to be the demand. And they've reforecasted, now it's going to be 18,000, a significant gap. And some of the things they do talk about are data centers, but there's a lot of different components that make that up. When I think about these problems, it's like, okay, I can understand that. And that's basically saying if everything stays the same until 2040, okay, maybe that's true. Well, being an Amazonian, right? I always go back to Jeff Bezos's quote, which is, your margin is our opportunity. Electricity is an input for many things we do here at AWS. And when you look at AWS and you look at our data centers, they're inherently more sustainable than others. In the United States, for example, we're 3.6x more efficient than your average data center. In Europe, it's 5x. If you look at some of the
Amazon
customers
versus your
versus
peers or
just
whatever.
any other data center that's out there.
Okay.
And I think you see many of these things across the industry. The other thing that you can see is we're coming out with custom silicon, right? And customers want this, but what we're getting out of it is a 60% reduction in energy comparable to some of our previous instances. And you're going to see this drive to go reduce, reduce, reduce. As just like another example, we just launched in Dublin, in a Dublin suburb, a heating scheme, right? This is a great way. This is an innovative approach. We're collaborating with industry and government. And what we're going to do is go heat local homes and university and council offices with the excess heat we get off the data centers. And so what we're going to see is we're going to see these kind of innovative ways. And I think AWS in particular, because we have a very large footprint and we've got scale, we're going to be able to do these things at scale and help reduce that power demand.
But to be clear, you're reducing power demand in a growing power demand environment, right? And so, like, does that mean in 2030 the demand for power will that is pulled for AI purposes will be less? Or it's like we're reducing it, but in an upward slope. Like, how should we think about that?
We do have a new workload called AI, and it is compute intensive, which means it uses a lot of power.
Yeah.
And every one of the silicon manufacturers today are trying to figure out a way to reduce that power, but we're also trying to use software to say, do I really need that many compute cycles to go do it? So you're going to see multiple levers that we're going to pull over time to be able to go reduce that power usage. The other thing is, don't forget about the fact that you know, people are moving to the cloud more and more often. And as you shut down the older data centers and you move to the cloud, we're 3x or 5x more energy efficient. So you're going to see that demand drop. Does it mean that there's not going to be an upward trend? I can't predict whether there's an upward trend or not. It looks like there will be. But at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is do what we're doing with water as an example. In 2030, we will be water positive, which means we will give more water back to the communities we're in than we actually take out. And this is the mindset we have. When you, again, I love Jeff's famous quote where he said, your margin is our opportunity. This is where we work extremely well, and we're able to go and drive those costs out and drive out those inefficiencies.
That makes sense. I mean, I guess for certainly in the near term, you know, as the tech takes off, it seems like the power demand is going to be greater, and then it'll be a matter of industry trying to figure out how do we reduce that demand through the different things that you just mentioned. But certainly sounds like we're going to be short a little bit of power going forward here.
Well, you know, having worked for GE and Siemens and been involved in power generation for many years, I think we're seeing a lot of people go, hey, we need more base load. And the renewables aren't quite making it yet. And I think we're seeing more and more of that. And I think this article I just recently saw with Georgia Power is yet another example of that. So the question is how do we as a country, how do we as the world go and address that?
Yeah, and that moves, you know, we can build out the renewables. We need to have that battery storage, longer term duration married to it in order to fit a pseudo baseload demand that we're going to see continue to grow, in my opinion, for sure. All right, we're getting towards the end here, and so lots of great things we've touched on, but maybe for listeners, you could share, you know, what kind of practical advice do you have for people who are looking to go on this AI journey besides some of the things that you've already said about starting simple?
Yeah, I mean, for kind of that AI journey, I think most people are going to generative AI. People are trying to figure out like, hey, how do I make some revenue out of it and so forth? I think before you get down that path, I think you need to think about kind of what your user interface is going to be. I believe that the back end pieces of it, the LLMs, there are some companies who are going to have to go create these new large language models like Facebook and OpenAI and AWS has created over time. But at the end of the day, most of us are just going to use those models. So I think the back end is going to be figured out. I think the innovation is going to happen on the front end. And when you think about a lot of corporations who aren't going to go and commercialize it, there are some really simple things you should really think about to be able to generate that positive momentum and confidence in the answers you're getting. The first I would make sure you do is, you know, you have the little box that asks a question and gives you an answer back. Well, a very simple thing to do is like make sure you have the links at the bottom that says, this is where I got the data from. So you can like click on the link and find it and verify it's correct. The second thing I like to see done is be able to have a glossary of terms. It gives you an answer back. There are terms in there. It should provide you a glossary of terms and explain what each one of those words means that were important in that response. So you can check to see, hey, are we on the same page? Or it said purple. Are we all on the same page of what purple means, right? And then the last thing I think is probably the most innovative thing, and that's to automatically generate the next set of questions that the generative AI thinks should be asked. So I'll give you an example. If you go and ask a question is, where should I go for vacation next week, right? It'll give you an answer back and say, okay, maybe you should go to Orlando or Disney World. But then it might ask you a set of questions and say, hey, listen, you should check to see at Disney World, what's the best time to visit? This time of year might not be good. And being able to have the generative AI generate new questions based on the question you asked and its answer could provide you another insight into the data set you're looking at, but also in another way to think about it. We see that happening quite often.
Or something you hadn't thought of that the model is kind of spinning back to you. Oh, did you think of this?
Andrew, I'd say one other thing is, I think that is the most innovative part of generative AI right now. Is it is finding things in data that we hadn't seen before. And we see that happen over and over again. I think that's one of the reasons why this is becoming so popular.
Yeah, I'll tell you, over the last few months, as you know, I've started to learn, like I said, more about the tech and understanding what we here at Enverus are doing. I couldn't be more excited. Not just because we have the platform with the clean analytics ready data, but we have over 25 years of insights written by the team that can, you know, combine with that data and, you know, bring together some of those insights, maybe whether it's in Instant Analyst or some of the other tools that we're developing.
I don't know what I'd do with 25 years of Andrew Glick. I that might be a little bit of overload for me.
That's that you don't have 25 years of Andrew Gillick, but the, you know, there's people who are far smarter than me been writing in the vault. So, well, look, Ben, it has been great having you on. Thank you so much for your time today, and you know, look forward to staying in touch. Take care, everyone. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks.